Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. 30 years ago, Bill McKibben offered one of the earliest warnings about climate change in his groundbreaking book, The End of Nature, which was the first book to alert us to global warming. In his latest book, Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out?, McKibben warns us that the danger is broader than that. Even as climate change shrinks the space where our civilization can exist, new technologies like artificial intelligence and robotics threaten to bleach away the variety of human experience. Today, we'll hear an interview I conducted with Bill McKibben on May 3rd while he was in Portland for an appearance at Powell's Books.
So I'm talking today with Bill McKibben, and he's just written a book called Falter, which is a book about everything that's wrong with the world. So welcome to KABU, Bill.
It's good to be with you.
As I was reading your book, I kept flashing on this passage from Ursula Le Guin's 1974 novel, The Dispossessed. Mm-hmm. So I thought I'd start out with this quote and have you respond to it. So remember, this was written in 1974 mm-hmm. here in Portland. She writes, this is the words of the ambassador from the Earth in some planet far away. "My world Earth is a ruin, a planet spoiled by the human species. We multiplied and gobbled and fought until there was nothing left, and then we died. We controlled neither appetite nor violence. We did not adapt. We destroyed ourselves, but we destroyed the world first. There are no forests left on my Earth. The air is gray. The sky is gray. It is always hot. You can see the old city still everywhere. The bones and bricks go to dust, but the little pieces of plastic never do. They never adapt either."
The description is all too accurate. We're in a world that's in a world of hurt, and it gets clearer with each passing day. I mean, as you and I are sitting here today, people are dying by the score in Mozambique, where the two largest cyclones in the history of the country hit back-to-back in the last month. In India today, the Indian government's trying to evacuate 11 million people out of the path of a cyclone, the greatest evacuation from a natural disaster in the planet's history. It does feel very science fiction. But I would say that that the passage manages to somehow blame all of us for this problem, and I think that's probably largely incorrect. I actually think it's a fairly small number of human beings, a vanishingly small number of the total, who should carry most of the blame for what we've done around climate change, and I think that the proof is fairly clear. I write in the book a lot about what we know about the fossil fuel industry in the early days of climate change, back in the 1980s. It turns out, from great investigative reporting by lots of good journalists over the last 4 years, that they studied this question hard, as you would expect. Exxon is the richest company in the world. Its product is carbon. It has great scientists. Of course, they're going to understand it. And they did. By 1982 or 1983, they knew everything there was to know. They knew how fast it was going to warm and how much. The executives believed the scientists. Exxon started building every drilling rig they built to compensate for the rise in sea level they knew was on the way. So let's imagine, in a kind of man in the high castle, alternate history kind of way, that in 1988, when Jim Hansen testified before Congress, that climate change was real, sort of opening the public debate on this question. Let's imagine that that night, the CEO of Exxon went on the evening news and said, "You know what? Our scientists are finding the same thing," which, by the way, seems to me just about the minimum that any moral or ethical code would demand. Had he done that, no one would have said, "Oh, Exxon, they're just a bunch of climate alarmists." We would have gotten to work. We would not have solved climate change by now, because it's a big problem, but we'd be well on the way. There were fairly modest steps 30 years ago that would have reoriented the ocean liner that is the world economy, and if it looked like it was veering only a few degrees at first over 30 years, it would end up in a different ocean. But of course, they didn't do that. They did just the opposite. They gathered together all the fossil fuel industry, and started hiring the veterans of the tobacco wars and the veterans of the DDT wars and putting together the architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation that kept us locked for 30 years in a completely phony debate about whether or not global warming was real. A debate both sides knew the answer to when it began. It's just one of them was willing to lie. And so that lie turned into the most consequential lie in human history. It cost us the 30 years that we needed to do something about this. 30 years we'll never get back. 30 years that may have been the crucial years. They took us from 1988, when Republican President George H.W. Bush said, "I pledge to fight the greenhouse effect with the White House effect," to Republican President Donald Trump declaring that climate change was a hoax manufactured by the Chinese. So for my money, it's a little much to kind of blame everyone on this. It's true that people drive and turn on the lights, and that's in the end what burns the fuel. But most people who turn on a light aren't hoping that the power came from a coal-fired power plant someplace. You only hope that if you own a coal mine. Most people would actually be quite happy that it came from the sun or the wind. And so I think that it's important that we take responsibility for our habits, especially those of us in the rich and consuming parts of the world. But I also think it's important that we not let the corporations off the hook, nor the ideologies that drove them. One of the important parts of this book is a long examination of the libertarian market solve all problems, laissez-faire ideology that took over our government beginning in the Reagan years and continues to this day. It was a great tragedy that that took hold, that kind of Ayn Rand blinkered view of the world, took hold at precisely the moment when we needed government to address these series of crises.
One of the things that I found really interesting about this Ursula Le Guin quote, though, is that it was written in 1974.
Yes, well.
And I know that science fiction writers tend to have a prescience that a lot of the rest of us don't have. And besides the fact that it does sound like she's blaming everybody, though, knowing Ursula's work and her
yes.
philosophy well, I know that's not the way she saw it.
It is the ambassador, after all,
right.
in her novel that's
exactly.
blaming everybody.
Right, and that what I see is that that even back in 74, people were talking about this, and
oh,
yet
sure.
it wasn't, this is even before Exxon proved that it was in fact happening.
1971 or so was when Limits to Growth was published. My old friend, the late Donella Meadows, and her then husband and the other rest of their team at MIT. And it had laid out quite plainly the kind of asymptotic exponential growth that we were starting to see and what its consequences were likely to be. We didn't know precisely what the mechanism would be, though in fact in the Limits to Growth they talk a little bit about CO2 presciently. But it was easy to predict that we were on a difficult to sustain course. It turns out that the contribution of climate change to this is so overwhelming that it's not just that we've poisoned our fields and made our own lives harder. We've become a geologically disruptive force. You know, 70% of the summer sea ice in the Arctic is gone. The oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 30 years ago. Down in a long list that, you know, ends with a city in California literally called paradise, literally turning into hell inside half an hour. So we had warning in the 70s, some, and we had very specific warning by the late 1980s, and that we didn't heed it is because people set out to make sure that we wouldn't. They devised a strategy to convince people that there was doubt where no doubt existed, and they did it in order to maintain their business model for a few more decades, even at the cost of breaking the planet, which probably is the cost.
A few days ago, I was listening to a speech by Al Gore that was being aired on American Public Broadcasting. And it was sounding very optimistic, and he was talking about what we can do, and he has lots of hope for the young people and what they would do. And I was thinking, boy, I wonder why he's so optimistic. And then at the end of the speech, they said it was recorded in 2009.
Yeah, so there's another decade that we lost. And really, in 2009, there was a certain, you know, that was another kind of climate moment. Gore's movie had just come out. We were getting ready for the climate conference in Copenhagen, which turned into a complete bust, and we wasted another decade. We're definitely in another climate moment right now, and it may be the last one of these that we get in time to do anything. This year's been very interesting. You'll remember last fall, the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, put out their most recent report, and it was really the one where they did the best job of communicating urgency. They said if we weren't well along this transition by 2030, then we wouldn't catch up with the physics of climate change. And that in turn spurred much of the thinking behind the Green New Deal, this remarkable idea that young people from the Sunrise Movement hammered out with the exemplary Bronx Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Markey of Massachusetts. And I've been crisscrossing the country, seeing them as they tour the country on the kind of roadshow promoting the Green New Deal. They've made great headway. The polling data for it is amazingly strong, even in the face of endless GOP mockery. Meanwhile, in London, Extinction Rebellion, with this remarkable display of nonviolent protest, shut down big parts of the city for a couple of weeks. People reacted well to it. The polling data showed that it really brought the question to top of mind. And 2 days ago, the British House of Commons, under a Tory conservative government, declared a climate emergency in the UK, the first government in the world to do so. And of course, this all is against the backdrop of the remarkable school strikes that began in September with Greta Thunberg and continue around the world. In fact, we're here on a Friday and there are school strikes in much of the planet today. I was looking at great pictures from our colleagues in Australia and elsewhere, and then around the United States of kids out doing their thing. So all of that's combined to produce some pretty remarkable things. The CNN poll this week of Democratic voters showed that climate change was far and away the top issue on the minds of people getting ready for this year's primaries. That's very new. I mean, we used to beg and plead to get one question in the debates about climate change, and we never did. That won't be a problem this year. All the Democrats are producing platforms and proposals sort of one after another to show their devotion to the cause. And I think that whoever wins the nomination, this will be one of the issues that they try to ram down the throat of the incumbent, because he's grievously out of touch with not just the science, but at this point, the American people on this question.
Well, I really appreciate your optimism, Bill, since your book depressed me quite a bit. But I just want to kind of throw out another kind of darkening loop here. Mm. Here in Portland, which we have a reputation of being one of the greenest cities in the country, and we passed the first fossil fuel infrastructure ban for any future fossil fuel storage facilities, we're now facing the burgeoning reality we may be the first export facility on the West Coast for exporting tar sands oil to Asia. And that's being, and it was done by this very crafty company, Zenith Energy, which bought out an old company that was basically moribund in the Portland port. And they expanded from shipping out a couple thousand dollars worth of crude oil to 17 million or something like that. And they are really increasing tar sands oil trains coming through Portland now. And they did it by finding a loophole in our rules.
Boy, let's hope people can figure out a way to stop that. Portlanders have done such a good job, and people across the river in Vancouver who managed to shut down plans for that big oil terminal. You know, it was valiant Portlanders who stopped the Shell drilling, you know, oil rigs for days in the harbor and so on and so forth, and who passed that remarkable bill last fall that takes some of the big box stores and things and gets them to work paying for the transition we need to clean energy. So Portland's done an awful lot. It doesn't mean for a minute that the fossil fuel guys aren't always looking for the loopholes and the ways around. It is maybe good news that at this point they have to find loopholes instead of going in the front door, which is what they did for 100 years.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're listening to an interview I conducted with Bill McKibben while he was in Portland on a book tour for his latest book, Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out?
Well, I want to go back to something you mentioned briefly at the beginning of this interview, which was talking about this libertarian, it's a far-right libertarian. In fact, libertarian feels like too kind a word for these people. And I want to just talk a little bit about the progression from Ayn Rand to the Koch brothers to Trump.
Well, Ayn Rand is arguably the most important philosopher of our time, not because of her ideas, which, as I say in the book, might as well have been written in crayon, but because of the way they were received by the very powerful. One of her real acolytes literally sat at her feet in the 1950s in New York was Alan Greenspan. And she was there when he was named chair of the President's Council on Economic Advisers. She died by the time he took over the Federal Reserve. But for 20 years, he was the most important person in the world. I mean, setting the world's economic policy at the moment that America was ascendant in the post-Cold War era. And so her prescription was followed pretty much to a T. This was the kind of, not just, this was the emotional core behind Ronald Reagan saying, government is the problem, not the solution. It was the emotional core behind Margaret Thatcher saying, there is no such thing as society. There are only individual men and women. These are poisonous ideas, and they've poisoned our politics. They account not just for the wild rise in temperature, but for the wild rise in inequality on this earth. They were the cover for the changes that result in the fact that we live on a planet where 8 people control as much wealth as the bottom 3.5 billion people. So if we're going to deal with climate change, if we're going to deal with inequality, we're going to have to deal with some of that way of looking at the world. That's why the Green New Deal is so interesting. It really posits human solidarity as the way out of this trap. I mean, yes, solar panels and wind power are super important, and the fact that engineers have brought their cost down 90% in the last decade is what gives us an outside chance of getting out of this. But it'll only happen if we figure out how to mobilize that human solidarity. That's why the Green New Deal includes healthcare for all and affordable college education and things like that, because we have to deal with the insecurity that keeps us locked in this sort of present sense set of economic arrangements.
I found it interesting in your book how you talk about all these people who were handing out copies of Ayn Rand's books, particularly Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, to their underlings and to all these people who are now in power who were given that book as a role model.
One after another. I mean, apparently Clarence Thomas, when he wasn't watching, you know, dirty movies, would convene seminars to make everybody at lunchtime read Ayn Rand. Donald Trump asked his favorite book, which is, I'm sure, not a long list to choose from, announced that it was The Fountainhead. He said, it contains everything. What it contains is a story of megalomaniac rich people taking everything over and a subplot of a guy, you know, one of these tycoons, raping women who fall in love with him for it. So you can, you know, 2 guesses as to why it's Donald Trump's favorite book.
I wonder if he actually read it over the Classics Illustrated version.
That's possible.
I was also thinking, as I was reading that in the TV show Mad Men, there's a scene that really got me where the older lead partner in the advertising firm gives Don Draper a copy of Atlas Shrugged. He says, you must read this. And this is his way of grooming the young rising star.
Yep. It's go sometime if you're in a fancy location someplace on the ocean and wander around the yacht basin and look at the biggest boats there, and a surprising number of them are named Atlas Shrugged or...
Well, let's move on from Ayn Rand to two people who are actively putting some of her ideas into reality and have had really a great deal of power in shaping what's going on right now, and that's the famous Koch brothers.
Right. So the Koch brothers are doctrinaire libertarians. An interesting life story, best told by Jane Mayer in her remarkable book, Dark Money. But, you know, their father begins the fortune by building refineries both for Stalin and Hitler, and then takes the money and comes back to the States and helps found the John Birch Society. The Koch brothers originally run for office on the libertarian ticket, but decide that's not going to work very well. Third parties in our country not working ever very well. And so they instead decide to purchase the Republican Party, a deed they carry out over the next 25, 30 years to the point where they're in virtually complete control. And they're serving both their ideological values and their brute self-interest. They're the biggest oil and gas barons in the country, so it's no wonder they don't like anything to do with climate change getting in the way.
So how have they been affecting some of their ideology?
Well, I mean, they get their power very easily. I mean, they pay for it. They're the biggest donors by far in our political system. The last time around, I think they outspent both the Democratic and Republican national committees combined. So, you know, given the post-Citizens United environment, they're able to hold just unfathomable sway. I mean, remember, it wasn't that long ago that Republicans were, you know, on environmental issues, not that out of step with the country. And now they're, you know, you can't get any of them to defend the basic idea of physics, you know? I mean, they've been told to behave like idiots, and so they are.
I want to give a little bit of a survey, or maybe a little bit of a spoiler about some of the other points that you
yes.
make in this book, because you really surprised me how you started out. It was just going to be another Bill McKibben on climate change and the sixth extinction. And then we got into Ayn Rand and the Koch brothers, and then from there we really went into a weird future. So let's move from Koch brothers
sure.
to the next logical progression in this kind of ideology of selfishness.
So I write a lot about, the third part of the book is about the set of tech advances that are right on the horizon. Advanced artificial intelligence, human genetic engineering. And the linkages are two. One, all the great tech billionaires of our time, Peter Thiel, Steve Jobs, whatever, they all worship Ayn Rand too. Their thing they want most in the world is for the government to leave them alone. I mean, as Mark Zuckerberg famously said, we wish to move fast and break things, and boy has he. And so that was one link, but the other, really more important, is that these technologies seem to me to be kind of the same place where climate change was in 1989 when I wrote the first book about it. That is, not yet having truly manifested in our world in their most dangerous ways, but their threat clearly visible and palpable. And so the hope, perhaps forlorn, is that this time we might have the discussion about them before they were completely out of control. They're getting close. As you know, in October, a Chinese doctor produced the first two designer babies on the planet. This has sparked some backlash from scientists who have tried to begin to draw some kind of at least temporary moratorium on this germline genetic modification, distinguishing it carefully from the use of genetic therapies to deal with people who have existing illnesses. The reason that they and I are concerned is because it's clear that what Silicon Valley wants to do with this stuff is set up a business where basically we turn people into products, where you walk into the clinic with your partner or not and pull out your credit card and choose the specs for your child in embryo. And if that happens, there are lots and lots of practical consequences, including, not incidentally, etching that inequality we've described into our genes. But for me, even more powerfully, real questions about human meaning, about the survival of the human game, the human project. I mean, imagine that you're a 13-year-old child and your parents, you know, have had in embryo engineered you so that you'd have perhaps a higher level of serotonin, dopamine, your mood would be improved, something that's probably within our capacity at the moment or close to it. And you wake up one morning and you're 13 and you find yourself feeling kind of giddy and happy about the world. And you don't know whether that's you reacting to things around you or your spec kicking in. Now imagine you're the brother or sister of that 13-year-old, a few years younger. When you were born, when you were in embryo, your parents had a little more money and technology had progressed somewhat farther, and so you got a better set of upgrades than your elder sister. What's your elder sister now? She's, I don't know, iPhone 6, Windows 2000, turning people into products, introduces obsolescence, a feature of all technologies that we know about, into this equation.
I'd just like to get a sense of what you'd like to see, or how you see that we can keep this reality from happening, as well as trying to forestall the worst aspects of climate chaos.
There's really only, in my experience, only one way to stand up to powerful forces, and that's to build movements. We came out of the 20th century with two great technologies, I think. One's the solar panel, which we've dramatically improved, and we can talk about that. It's a beautiful story. The other is nonviolent social movements. This is how, thanks to the suffragists, thanks to Gandhi, thanks to Dr. King, this is how we've learned to let the small and many stand up to the mighty and few. I can tell you from my own experience that they are hard to organize and they don't always win. But that is our chance here. And hopefully the human solidarity, that's what movements are all about, is our hope.
So you talk about how people in Silicon Valley are very interested in creating designer children. But it seems like some of their futuristic tendencies go beyond that. And actually, some of the things you were describing in the book make me really wonder about where these people's minds are at.
Well, what seems to be dominant in their minds, and this is curious, but by all accounts true, is the incredible desire to somehow ward off dying. That seems to be the ultimate goal of an immense amount of what's going on. So I interview, for instance, Ray Kurzweil, the chief scientist at Google, who explains quite patiently that he takes 120 pills a day, different vitamins and wonder drugs and things, all in the effort to make sure that he's still alive by 2030 when he thinks he'll be uploaded into a computer or that there'll be nanobots able to repair his ailing organs or whatever it is. This is, on the one hand, crazy talk, and on the other hand, it's crazy talk from the director of engineering at the richest corporation the world's ever seen. When we talk about, you know, science fiction, Ursula Le Guin and Margaret Atwood hinted at this kind of future, but I think, you know, they would be a little surprised to see it kind of playing out.
Actually, Doris Lessing, and she did a very wonderful series of science fiction books, I think, like in the late 70s, mm-hmm. and she actually described this whole thing where people would get artificial organs, and mm-hmm. so they would live maybe 400 or 500 years. Mm-hmm. It was a lot. The idea of only living for 70 years mm-hmm. seemed really pathetic to them. So that was some of the thinking in the '70s that maybe this is good that we can actually have artificial organs and we can extend our lives. Though I don't think in any science fiction that I read that was trying to put a positive spin on this, the idea would be that you would live forever, mm-hmm. which seems to be kind of complicated and problematic.
Well, all of it seems problematic to me. I mean, I'm 58 and I'm tired already. You know, it's hard for me to imagine why anyone wants to live forever, much less 500 years, you know, anything. But obviously, it's, you know, it's, we're not talking about doing it for everybody. We're talking about doing it for very rich people who incidentally are all building rocket ships to leave for Mars anyhow. So, you know, there's a kind of, at one level, it's kind of funny, and at another level, it's a kind of deep rejection, all of this, of being human in the ways that we're used to being human. The creature who dies, the creature who lives in community, surrounded by, you know, deeply social primate. Those are the things that these guys can't stand. And it's very interesting to kind of think about why and where it all goes.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're listening to an interview I conducted with Bill McKibben while he was in Portland on a book tour for his latest book, Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out?
What's your theory? Why do you think they can't stand the thought of dying?
I think that they've, if you have, you know, the odd $10 billion, you've had everything that you ever wanted, you know, available to you, and so this must seem like the next thing. And I'm as interested in their fanatical desire to leave the planet, too. And the book ends at Cape Canaveral watching one of Elon Musk's rockets go into space. Every one of these guys, Paul Allen, Bezos, you know, all your friends from the Pacific Northwest, for some reason want to trade the beauty of Oregon and Washington for the wasteland of, you know, Mars or wherever else it is they're planning to go.
Well, I was saying when I first heard about Elon Musk's plan to go to Mars, I said, "Wait, bring your own atmosphere."
Part of me thinks all of this is not the worst plan in the world. I mean, getting all these guys away would, but they're definitely not planning to take the rest of us. And really what it is just a sad neglect, inability to appreciate the world that they were born into. You know, a world of exquisite beauty, the least habitable square meter of planet Earth, someplace out in the Sahara or high in the Himalayas or something, is 1,000 times more habitable than any place else in the solar system. I mean, yes, it's true that in the Martian, Matt Damon managed to grow a few potatoes using his own dung, you know, as the fertilizer. But that, you know, take a trip to Iowa sometime and see what topsoil looks like, you know?
Or even the Willamette Valley.
Actually. There you
go. Pretty good topsoil here, too. One of the senses that I get about people who want to escape is that they're not making the connection between the impacts that their work and their philosophy have on the environment here and leading up to the destruction of Earth as we know it. So they don't make that connection. They just think they can go somewhere else.
Well, and this all fits beautifully into this libertarian fantasy world. I mean, Peter Thiel, one of the richest guys in Silicon Valley, wanted to build a floating seastead where there would be no laws. One of these rocket billionaires said, well, one of the great things about space is no one can make you pay your taxes, you know? I mean, that's the kind of, they want to do what they want to do and damn anybody else.
Well, one of the interesting things I found in your book was when you talk about, and we haven't gotten this, we should go back to artificial intelligence, which was for following this logical conclusion, but that you see people who have cell phones, particularly smartphones, glued to their ears, that they're already partly artificial
We're
intelligence.
We're all slightly, you know, on this path already. The physicians, the orthopedists have started to diagnose something they call eye posture, the kind of crook in the slight hunchback that comes from bending your neck 8 hours a day to look at the small rectangle of glass in your palm. Now, none of this is to say that technology is, all of it is bad idea. In some ways, the last quarter of this book is a hymn to the technology of the solar panel. which strikes me as holding the potential for incredible democratization of our most basic commodities. When you see it, I mean, we tend to not really think about what a miracle it is, because for us, it's mostly comes in the form of replacement power, you know? You had a coal-fired power plant, now you have a solar farm, and it doesn't really make any difference. But I spent a lot of time in remote parts of Africa, both west and east, watching as the solar revolution suddenly, very suddenly, hits there. There's a billion people on the planet with no power at all, okay? And they were never going to get it from fossil fuel. No one was going to build the grid out to rural Tanzania or the hinterlands of the Ivory Coast. Instead, they're now quickly getting solar power in place after place because it's so cheap. And you really get a sense of its miraculous nature when you're in a place that yesterday and for a million yesterdays had no power, and now all of a sudden the doctor who used to deliver babies maybe with a flashlight in his teeth has a refrigerator to store vaccine. I was sitting with the elders of a village in Ghana in the great equatorial heat, and they kept handing me cold bottles of water to drink, for which I was grateful. But it took me a good quarter hour in my clueless Western way to figure out why they were so proud. Until the solar microgrid had gone in the week before, there'd never been anything cold in that village ever, you know? And when you see that, you realize that this is, you know, Hogwarts scale magic. You take a sheet of glass, you point it at the sun, out the back comes cold and light and information and modernity. I mean, forget water into wine. That's a pretty good miracle.
Well, one of the concerns that some people raise about solar energy, though, I think that the microgrids you're describing are ideal. I was talking with a tribal member of the Klamath tribes down in Southern Oregon a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how creating these huge solar panel farms, which they're doing now in the deserts, particularly in the Southwest, that's actually robbing the earth from the sunlight that should go to the earth. I mean, he's all for solar power, but he thinks on the industrial scale it's a problem.
Maybe, but there's no free lunch with energy, and everything is relative to everything else. Given the number of electrons we use and that we're likely to continue to use for the foreseeable future, some of the solar panels, or some of the solar installations, are going to have to be big. I mean, and you know, where I live in Vermont, people sometimes complain about that. Oh, it's, you know, taking up farm. Those are fields in Vermont where we're busily growing a different kind of solar collector, a corn plant, for which we have to dump huge amounts of nitrogen on the fields in order to make them grow. All we do is feed them to cows to get milk that we already have in great surplus, so all the dairy farmers are going out of business anyway. Allowing farmers to grow a crop that we actually use and need, electrons, is in many cases a very good thing for the farmer, who now has a crop that comes at a stable price. And it's not bad for the land beneath it. I mean, the land beneath it, someday if we don't need them anymore and we pull up the solar panels, there's land that hasn't been pesticided and herbicided within an inch of its life every growing season.
I think that this man is in particular not talking about changing, using farmland that's commercial industrial farmland, but more probably thinking about wild spaces, desert, and places that I think are untouched.
You don't want to use all of them. And you want to be wise when you're doing it, but there's a certain amount of triage that comes when you think about climate change. I mean, the alternatives at this point are losing literally every living system on planet Earth. That's what runaway climate change means. So would that there were a totally magic way to generate power. I don't think there is.
But I also talk with people who feel that this whole challenge of finding a way towards renewable energy is also an opening for more community-based energy production.
I think that community ownership of energy as much as possible is a very good thing. It's one of the reasons that this worked so well in Germany is that this the law that the Energiewende, the German law that set up the feed-in tariff that led to the rapid expansion of the solar industry, allowed community groups, churches, others to own much or all of this new production. And that, among other things, makes them all much more palatable. People in Germany don't complain about windmills in the same way that people in the States do, in large part because each turn drops a few more Deutschmarks or euros or whatever they use now in the bank account.
As we're talking about renewables, there's also a lot of discussion that goes on, particularly in the fossil fuel sector, about the bridge fuel. And that's one of the big struggles we have right now here in the Northwest, is that there are several of these, quote, bridge fuel projects being proposed, particularly methanol and LNG. And I wanted to spend the last part of this interview talking about the fallacy of that and how we sure. counter, because natural gas has been sold to us for years and years as the clean alternative sure. to dirty fossil fuel.
So I've done a lot of writing about this over the last 7 or 8 years, and some of it's in this book, Falter. Look, that was the understanding circa 2008, 2009, that A, renewables were expensive and a long way off, so we needed a bridge fuel, and B, using natural gas would provide us with power at with half the level of greenhouse gas emissions. Both those things turn out to be incorrect. As it turned out, renewable energy was much closer to hand than anyone thought. Now, sun and wind are the cheapest way to generate power around the world. So the idea that we need a bridge is wrong, and the idea that natural gas could provide that bridge is wrong. What we learned beginning about 2011 or so from particularly a couple of great professors at Cornell, Bob Howarth, Tony Ingraffia, was that the life cycle of fracking liberated lots and lots of methane to the atmosphere. CH4 methane is a very potent heat-trapping gas, depending on how you measure it, 50, 60, 70 times more potent than CO2. It lasts not as long in the atmosphere, but right now, when we're breaking the back of the climate system, it's a horrendous add-on. And so, if anything, generating power with natural gas turns out to be less friendly to climate change than doing it with coal. I mean, so on no account does this argument make sense anymore. But that doesn't stop people who are invested in it or want to make money on it or whatever. And they got enormous political power. Some of it from the Obama administration. This was the sort of preferred solution to global warming during the Obama years. And some of his, you know, high-ranking energy officials have gone on to be on the boards of the companies now busily shipping LNG around the world and so on.
Well, even before 2008, 2009, I was in a seminar down at USC in 2002, mm-hmm. and it was about water in the West, but we had a discussion about energy future. Mm-hmm. And the debate actually included, at that time, nuclear power. And there was mm-hmm. one person on this panel who was promoting nuclear power as the only alternative that would be a bridge fuel. And then this other scientist was suggesting natural gas. Well, it was before there was a lot of fracking, actually. Mm-hmm. And then there was somebody else who was like, oh, you're all wrong. You know, we can just do renewables now. But I find, like, there's still people. I know that I'm not sure if Jim Hansen still is promoting nuclear mm-hmm. power, but a few years ago he was.
Yeah. And the problem, I mean, everybody knows the problems with nuclear power, the things that we've talked about for a long time, proliferation, waste, so on. Let's lay those aside for a moment. And Jim Hansen thinks that there'll soon be a new generation of nuclear power plants that solve some of those. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a physicist. Maybe so. The problem with them for the foreseeable future, i.e. for the period of time when we have to address climate change, is above all that they're expensive. You know, you might as well just pull $20 bills out of your wallet and burn them to generate power. The price of a solar panel has dropped 90% in the last decade, the price of a nuclear reactor just keeps going up, 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 up. That's because they're not nimble, decentralized, flexible. They're hulking, centralized, and incredibly expensive. And so on all these, you know, both with gas and nuclear, the logical place now is to be moving very quickly to renewable energy. There was a study yesterday that showed if you took a city like Los Angeles, which everybody has seen sprawling beneath them from an airplane sometime or another, that if you could take just 75,000 rooftops in that city and put solar panels on them, and the study looked at doing it in low-income neighborhoods where there'd be a huge boost to power costs, coupled those with the batteries that people like Elon Musk, to give him credit, have really managed to produce now at low cost, that would be enough to displace one of the big gas-fired power plants in the city of Los Angeles. That's pretty good. That's what we should be doing, and doing very fast, because unlike a nuclear power plant, that if you start building it now, you know, you'll finish it 15 years hence, you know, you can go out to, I mean, I spent a day with the guys from the biggest solar installing company in the country a couple years ago for the New Yorker. They can finish a house inside 8 hours, you know, and have it ready to switch on.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're listening to an interview I conducted with Bill McKibben while he was in Portland on a book tour for his latest book, Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out?
I have this image of kind of the fallacy of bridge fuels, maybe. I took a boat ride up the Columbia River across from where the methanol facility is being proposed in Kalama, Washington, which is about 40 miles downriver from Portland. I wasn't surprised about looking at the landscape, which is just a beach right now, in a pretty open, semi-pristine area close to the industrialized part of Kalama's port. But right across the river, due across, is the remains of the Trojan nuclear power plant. And I just thought that was a very interesting metaphor.
The problem with renewable energy, from the point of view of people who've been in the energy business for a long time, is that while you can make money from it, and there's going to be solar billionaires eventually, you can't make Exxon-scale money on it. And the reason is clear. Once you build the solar panel, the sun comes for free, which from Exxon's point of view is the stupidest possible business model imaginable. They've spent 100 years getting rich by making people write a check every month for some more of this. It's also the reason why this will be a tool, not a perfect tool that accomplishes everything, but a tool for helping rebalance wealth and power in our society. Since sun and wind come from everywhere, by their nature, they begin to localize commodities that now are very heavily centralized. And if you think about it, an awful lot of the people who hold way too much power in our society, the Koch brothers, the Saudi royal family, Vladimir Putin, hold it because they happen to control these small patches of ground where coal and gas and oil can be found. Given that no one owns the sun, it can't help but make things at least a little more democratic.
Well, another thing that I've given a lot of thought about, especially since I just had a hot water heater replaced a couple days ago, and unfortunately we had to stay with gas because it was going to cost about $5,000 to run a 220 electrical outlet over to where it went. And we did a lot of thinking about it and went back to this. But I was so aware while they were doing this process of all the dangers of this gas, and at one point I could smell a little gas outside and I was freaking out. The fact is that gas explodes, oil sinks and also can explode, and coal is just a big disaster. The sun is clean and it's not dangerous, and the same with windmills. I mean, windmills, well, we'll give them, they do kill birds.
But we call a solar spill a sunny day. I mean, it's... And yeah, I mean, badly designed windmills kill some birds. Well designed, very few, much, you know, certainly no more than all the transmission lines and tall buildings and things we've built across the landscape. I gotta say, I think we're gonna need some new aesthetics for this millennium. I think there's something kind of beautiful about a windmill turning on the horizon. there's a grace to it, and there's also a kind of recognition of some kind of responsibility, that energy is not something you get by blowing up someone else's mountaintop or whatever it is, that you've taken some responsibility where you can see it.
I think also we should give some credit to the windmills have come a long way. So I remember the first time I saw the Altamont windmills.
Those were bird Cuisinarts, man.
Yeah, and there was something, and also it was a landscape I was really familiar with. I remember it very well from when I lived in the Bay Area. And to see it covered with these strange things moving around, it was kind of a heartbreak.
Right.
But I don't feel that way about the Columbia Hills windmills, which are many more than there are in Altamont. And it's a landscape I feel much more attached to.
Yep.
And I think that there's something about the way that we've learned to build windmills that's really changed.
Yep. Well, they move, you know, they're big enough now that they turn slowly against the landscape.
What is your hope for the future, if we're going to have one?
Well, my hope is that we rise to build the kind of movements to stand up to entrenched power in our society, that we take this opportunity that this crisis provides and use it to build a different world. I think we're capable of doing that. I do not know if we're capable of doing it fast enough. The thing that scares me about climate change, and indeed about some of these other technologies, is that they're coming with enormous speed. And unlike other political problems that we face, they're timed tests. If we get healthcare wrong, that's bad. You know, lots of people will suffer until we get Medicare for All or whatever we're gonna get. But the intervening years won't make it harder to do the right thing eventually, you know. With climate change, we do not have that luxury. Past certain tipping points, it becomes an insoluble problem. And those tipping points are obviously approaching fast. There are scientists who think we've slipped past them already, though the consensus is we have a narrow closing window, not to stop climate change, but to keep it from getting so out of control that we can't have civilizations like the ones we're used to. But as I say, narrow and closing window, if we don't move with real nimbleness, no chance of escape.
Well, I'm trying to eke out of you just a little word of optimism.
I'm very optimistic about the movements that we've watched build. That's exciting. And we'll get many more opportunities. You know, the kids have shown the way with this climate strike stuff. Keep your eyes peeled, because there's going to be a call coming soon for adult, all ages, climate strikes. A, because it's a little undignified to let 12-year-olds do all the work, and B, because some disruption of business as usual is what we need. If you think about it, it's business as usual that's doing us in. The fact that we each get up every day and do more or less the same thing we did yesterday, even as the worst thing that ever happened to the planet is in the process of happening. We've got to overcome that.
Well, Bill, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. What a good talk.
Today, we heard an interview I conducted with Bill McKibben on May 3rd while he was in Portland on a book tour for his latest book, Falter: Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you would like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk about the Juliana versus United States lawsuit brought against the United States government on behalf of young people who see their future threatened by inaction on climate change. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Anna Fritz. Thanks for listening.
Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, and turn the ships around. Keep it going. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people, we turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, turn the ships around. We are a people, we are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding, turn the ships around. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding, turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around.